It's time for us to begin our class in here. We continue our study in the book of Deuteronomy. And again, here's our outline. We are going to be switching lines in our outline tonight. We're finishing up this section here, talking about the relationship with God, moving into the many commandments, talking about those things tonight as we get into chapter 12. We were just finishing up, or hadn't quite finished up, the end of chapter 9. And if we turn your attention to Deuteronomy chapter 9, we're looking there as we finish up. Moses had been busy telling them about all the things he'd done for them. On several occasions, Moses had spoken up on behalf of the people to God. And he's talking specifically what happened there at Sinai. And God says in chapter 9, verse 13, "The Lord spoke further to me, saying, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stubborn people.'" And so he was going to destroy them, and Moses said, "I fell down before the Lord," verse 18, "as at the first 40 days and nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water," and talked about what he had done for them. And the Lord listened to him, and he did not destroy them. You go over to verse 25. He says again, retelling what he did. "So I fell down before the Lord those 40 days and nights, which I did because the Lord had said he would destroy you. I prayed, O Lord God." And we talk about what he did for the people. In verse 29, he says, "Yet they are your people, even your inheritance, whom you have brought out by your great power and your outstretched arm." And so this, again, kind of reminding God of what God had done for them. These are your people that you brought out. If you want to write out here in verse 29, Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 10, Nehemiah, in his prayer to God, when Nehemiah was informed of the state of Jerusalem and no city, no fortification for the city there, he prayed to God in captivity, asking for forgiveness, and quotes this passage here in his prayer to God. What God, I was talking specifically about what God had done for them. So we go into chapter 10 and get into talking about some authority. We begin seeing a few things that God did and a few examples of authority. What do we see here early on? What is God doing with Moses at this time in the first few verses here? The second tablets, right? So Moses comes down the mountain. People are doing things they shouldn't be doing. And they have the calf. We talked about this last Wednesday. And he breaks the tablets. And so he goes back up the mountain. "At that time, the Lord said to me, 'Cut out for yourself two tablets of stone like the other ones that you had just broke and come up to me on the mountain.'" Now, what is the significance of the peep of Moses? Was he just angry and just threw the tablets down and broke them? Do y'all have an opinion on that? Let me just say that the text doesn't tell us specifically why he broke them. But the people had figuratively already broken them. Do you understand what I'm saying? The people had already broken the commandments that they had already heard from God on the mountain. They had heard these commandments already, and the people broke them. And so, in like manner, Moses breaks those tablets. Possibly, I don't know, but the text doesn't tell us, but it's something to think about. And here we see that he's going to make them like the former ones. Verse 2, "I will write." Who's speaking here in verse 2? God is. "I will write on the tablets the words that are on the former." Now, if you want to take a moment, look over in Exodus chapter 34. Exodus 34, in verse 28. Let's begin in verse 27. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you in Israel.' So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, and he did not eat bread or drink water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments." So who wrote what? Look at Exodus chapter 34, verse 28. Seems to say that Moses, he wrote these. What's that? No, the text over here says, "I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets, which you shattered, and you shall put them in the ark." So we are looking at a situation here where it's the he isn't really descriptive. It's he, capital H, God wrote them, and then we see Moses, God writing them again here like he had done before. He looked down in verse 4. He wrote on the tablets like the former writing, the Ten Commandments which the Lord had spoken. So clearly, Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 2 and 4 say God wrote, just like he did in the former tablets, God wrote the tablets, wrote them, the Ten Commandments on the tablets. When you read here in chapter 30, Exodus chapter 34, verse 28, and if somebody wants to bring it up, like there's a contradiction here, it's not a contradiction. The he is a, should be a capital H in the language, and they have, it is God who wrote all the tablets of the commandment, of the Ten Commandments on the tablets. So not Moses. Just so in case y'all are reading along in your text and you see that and say, wait a second, over in Deuteronomy it says God wrote them, but in Exodus it says he wrote them, but the he is God in Exodus. So, what's that? I'm sorry, what?
Exodus 34:27.
Yes, then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words. In accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you. So he was there with the Lord. We see God writing them both times. He wrote on the tablets like the former writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you. I will write on the tablets the words. In chapter 10 of Deuteronomy, it's God who's saying he is going to write the tablets like he did the former tablets. But we see these commandments are authoritative, and we see the chapter here is authoritative, different sections of authoritative information. Look in chapter 10, verse 6. Now the sons of Israel set out from Beeroth and Bereth and came to these different places, and Aaron died there, and he was buried, and Eleazar, his son, ministered as priest in this place. In verse 8, set apart for the tribe of Levi, and we begin talking about Levi and carry out the Ark of the Covenant. Why would we be talking about the Ten Commandments, be talking about Eleazar and making that change, and then be talking here about Moses as well in verse 10. I, moreover, stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Which, by the way, he was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, fasting, not eating or drinking anything, came down the mountain. We don't know how long he was off the mountain, if he got a hamburger or not, but he went back up on the mountain and then had another 40 days and 40 nights of fasting. And so I don't know if you guys have fasted before, but that's a long time to be fasting. So why do you think these things are coupled together here in this section of Scripture? You have the law, you have the high priest, you have the Levites, and you have Moses all kind of being brought up again here together in this package. Why again, when we're dealing with a second giving of the law, why are we bringing this up? To remind them, right? That's kind of the theme throughout the book. We are reminding them of these things. And here, they are reminded of these authoritative figures. The words of God are authoritative. They are given and need to be heeded. And we'll talk more about that later on. And so we are again reminded of these authoritative figures in early on in this chapter. Verse 12, we see sort of a change in this chapter. This is a rather important verse in the book. And I'd like to ask you, have verses 12 and 13, has that changed? I mean, maybe the commandments and the statutes are no longer the same, but has the concepts changed of verses 12 and 13? No, of course not. So if you were to ask this question again, what does God require of us? It's the same, that's not changed. Those are the same requirements still. God still requires that we pay attention, that we listen to him. Behold, to the Lord God belong heaven and earth and the highest heavens and the earth, and that is all that is in it. Verse 14, yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection. Verse 14 talks about God and all that belongs to him. God and everything that is in the realm of his authority. Verse 14. And then he says, what about the people of Israel? Verse 15. They were chosen. So here we have verse 15. God could have chosen anybody, is what he's saying. God could have chosen anything, and he chose their forefathers, and he chose these people in order to do his good. Now, if you go back a couple chapters, we read earlier in chapter 9, verse 4, don't say in your heart when the Lord your God has driven them out before you, because of my righteousness that they were chosen. It wasn't because they were that great. And God says, remember, it's because they're that bad, right? So, but it's interesting that he would say that before and then say this here, that God had chosen them above all peoples as it is this day. Verse 16, circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. Have you heard this concept of circumcising the heart before? Possibly heard that before. When we study about circumcision, we read, of course, earlier on in the law that it was commanded for that to happen on the eighth day. And when we go into the New Testament talking about circumcision, it becomes something that is done away with. Look over in Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2, this practice obviously is no longer for religious purposes, no longer done. Romans chapter 2, beginning of verse 25. For indeed circumcision is of no value if you practice a law, but if you are a transgressor of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. So if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? So he is talking to them and bringing up the fact that the circumcision is no longer valid. The physical concept of circumcision is no longer valid. And Paul teaches against this here in this section of Scripture. Look over also in Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. Galatians chapter 6, 12 through 16. Those who desire to make a good showing in the flesh try to compel you to be circumcised, simply so that they will not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. For those who are circumcised do not keep the law themselves, but they desire to have you circumcised so they may boast in your flesh. This was something that was happening in that time, that there were people who were coming to Christ, and those who were Jews previously teaching them about Christ, but still requiring practices of the Old Testament, namely circumcision. Now, Paul's teaching this, right, and he's a strong opponent against, or you know, circumcision. But why, in Acts chapter 16, why do we have Timothy circumcised? Acts chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. Why did Paul have Timothy circumcised? What's that? He wasn't a Jew, right? So Timothy wasn't a Jew. He was half Jew. But why would he, if it's not valid, right? We're in Acts chapter 16. We're way beyond Acts chapter 2 and way beyond. Why would he still have Timothy circumcised? Look at the text for credibility. Acts chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. He had a good report. But he was already known that his father was not a Jew and that he was not circumcised. And so Paul wanted this man to go with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those parts. He wanted to be able to take him into the synagogues and wanted him to be able to go wherever he went. And so that was sort of a rite of passage in order for that to happen. It was accommodative in order for him to be able to go into these areas. And so this concept of doing all things to be able to speak to people, that was something that Timothy did in practice in order to be able to speak. It was not because Timothy believed. That was something that he spiritually needed to do. It was something that he would be able to have a larger audience and be able to help Paul more if that was the case. I want to look over in Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. We're still dealing with this even towards the end of the book of Acts. We're still dealing with this concept. When Paul goes back to Jerusalem before he's tried and seized in the temple, he goes back and talks about the things that they had done. In Acts chapter 20, beginning of verse 19, so he talks about all the things that they had done and what he'd done amongst the Gentiles. This is Acts chapter 21, rather. 21, I don't know if I said the other. Acts 21, 19. And what God had done with the Gentiles, and they heard that it began to glorify God. And in verse 20, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are zealous for the law. And they have been told about you, that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children nor walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come to be there in Jerusalem. They ask him to keep a custom. They ask him to keep a custom, to make it look like he's still doing some of the practicing, some of the law. And Paul acquiesces and does this thing and goes up to the temple and does this thing. There are times when there are things we need to do because we need to accommodate and help people understand. That's what Timothy did in the circumcision he did. That's what Paul does here in Acts chapter 20. The old law is already done away with. This concept of circumcision is already done away with. But he is accommodative to those people in order that he will still be able to have a voice amongst them. It meant nothing to Paul, as he knows what was currently standing, what was authoritative in that moment. So that practice is done away with. But even in the Old Testament, we see God already talking about circumcision of the heart. God already talking about those things that we needed to do in order to be circumcised of the heart. Look over in Colossians chapter 2. Beginning of verse 11, Colossians chapter 2. Let's begin in verse 9. For in him, talking of Christ, the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you have been made complete, and he is the head over the and rule over all authority. And in him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised up with him in the working of God who raised him from the dead. So this idea of circumcising your heart, the idea of being obedient to God is what this is talking about. Circumcising the heart, making the heart soft and ready to be receiving of God's message is what we're talking here. And so throughout the book of Deuteronomy, we see this idea of making sure your heart is in the right place, that your heart is where it needs to be. And so they need the heart that is ready to receive God's message, and they do not need to be stubborn, is what this verse is telling us. But the idea of circumcision would later be done away with, and Paul taught against it, and taught rather that us actually putting Christ on a baptism is a form of that. So it's important that we see this idea as underlying kind of thing. Yes, there are laws. Yes, there are outward things that you're supposed to do, but the heart must be engaged in the doing of them. Verse 17, for the Lord your God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords, great and mighty. In chapter 10, of back to Deuteronomy, awesome God who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So here is our God in verses 17 and 18. Here's our God. Here are some attributes of our God. And in verse 19, he says, so show your love to the alien. Which is to say what? Should we take bribes or show partiality? Should we be champions for the widow and the orphan and the alien that sojourns among us, so to speak? Yes. That's the other side of that. Here's where God is, so we should also be that way. You shall fear, verse 20, fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him, and you should cling to him. This word here is the idea of to chase after, to catch by pursuit. How many of you have ever dealt with children, toddlers, and their tiny hands? And those tiny hands that they stick in their mouth are like sticky and kind of gummy all the time. Have you ever seen them be just like as fast as lightning and grab something you'd already told them not to grab? Or maybe their hands get tied up in your hair and they just cling on. Have you ever seen a baby grab onto something and they cling onto that? You've seen a child cling to its mother? This is the idea of that, to cling to something, to cling to God is what he's saying here. And so Moses over and over again is trying to get Israel to be together with their God, to cling to them. And this is an interesting language that he uses here, to cling to God, to chase after him as though by pursuit, to catch. He is your praise, verse 21. Here's what God has done for you. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all, and now the Lord your God has made you numerous as the stars of heaven. That promise that was fulfilled and the promise that was made to Abraham is being fulfilled here. Chapter 11, we see this reward idea, the rewards of obedience. We're seeing this over and over again. He talks about these words in verse 1, his charge, his statutes, his ordinances, and his commandments. This is when people think about religion, when they think about what it is to serve God, maybe this is what they focus on, right? And this is what we focus on. These are all the things that we're supposed to do and not supposed to do. That's religion in a lot of people's minds. But that is not what he's trying to say here. These are the commandments. But what has he said over and over again? Why does God want them to be obedient? Why does he want them to serve? To listen to his commandments. It's to pass it down to the generations. It's something that needs to be passed. So be obedient so you can pass it down to the next generation. That's something. He said several times that it might be well with you, right? And that's something that he's trying to get to them to understand. This is what God has done. His greatness, his mighty hand, his outstretched arms. In verse 3, his signs, his works. He's talking about all the things that he has done for them, that he did in Egypt's army, to the horses in verse 4, that he did to you in the wilderness. And so he's talking to the people about all the things God has done. He talks about the rebellion and how the ground swallowed up those who were rebellious in verse 6. And he says, but your own eyes have seen all the great work which the Lord he did. You shall therefore keep the commandments. So he's using all those things, reminding them again of all those things God has done. Keep the commandments of God. He has been faithful. He's been doing what he said he's going to do. Make sure that you do these things. And he says, I am commanding you this day, verse 8, so that you may be strong and go in and possess the land. In Joshua, they took Jericho, right? They took Jericho and they tried to take Ai, but it didn't work. Why was the first time they tried to take the city of Ai, why did that not work? Do you remember? Somebody sinned. There was sin in the camp. Somebody took from Jericho and they weren't supposed to. And so God is serious about this. If you will listen to me, you will be strong and you will be able to take over the land. But if you don't, then things are not going to work out so well for you. Verse 9, so that you may prolong your days in the land. You'll be there a long time. Were they there forever? I mean, it might have seemed like forever, but did they eventually get taken out of the land that they were in? They did. God was serious about that too. They could have been there longer, but God was serious about it. Verse 10, for the land to which you are entering to possess is not like the land of Egypt, which you came where you used to sow your seed and water it with your foot like a vegetable garden. What does it mean to water it with your foot? Is that what how your text reads? Water it with your foot? Did you guys ever study ancient civilizations and like the Fertile Crescent and all that and have to learn about the Nile River and all the civilizations along the Nile River? Did y'all study that when you were growing up? I don't know why, but we studied it like 3 times. I don't know why. Maybe switched schools. I don't remember. But the Nile River floods once a year. Remember that? The plain floods. Everything floods. It brings the silt down from the north up from the south. It's weird. Anyway, and it floods everywhere, and they irrigate from the Nile. Guess what power they use to power their irrigation mechanisms? Slave foot power. So they had the different wheels, they had different mechanisms that they were used to water and irrigate. So it's possible that we're talking about these kind of like treadmill irrigation systems in order to water all these crops. And God is saying the crops that you're going to have, the place you're going into, you're not going to need those treadmill machines in order to water your crops because God is blessing you and He will bless you with the rains. But the land you're going into, well, you don't need any of that kind of stuff. It drinks the water from the rain of heaven. And as long as you're doing what God wants you to do, God will bless you. And God blesses you with water year-round, not just the flood season. God blesses you with water year-round, even to the end of the year. But this will only happen if you listen obediently to my commandments and you love the Lord your God and serve Him with all your heart, with all your soul. Have you heard that before? It's like a second. This is the second part of the Shema, this prayer that's being used by the continue to use this as a tradition. So we have this second giving of the Shema here, and we have this restatement of obeying God and serving Him with your everything, and that He will give you the rain that you want, and the late rain, and the early rain, and all the rains, and He'll give you grass in your fields. Why do we want grass in our fields? For the animals, right? Not to mow, so our animals can mow it, right? That's why we want the grass in our fields. What is the warning in verse 16? What's our warning? Serve other gods, right? We don't want to be doing that. And we see in verse 18, you shall therefore impress these words of mine on your heart and on your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand. This is verbatim, almost very similar to what we see in Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5. You shall teach them to your sons, talking of them. And we see this same idea of passing on this generational information. So your days and the days of your sons will be multiplied, in verse 21. And they will not really live long on the earth. For if you are careful to keep the commandments, to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, and to hold fast to Him, to cling to Him, the Lord will drive out all the nations before you. And the idea is that as long as you are getting close to God, clinging to Him, be obedient to Him, all the nations, everything is going to go well. Things will be great. But when you start to turn away from Him, then things will go downhill. And we see that cycle over in the Judges, right? We see that cycle later on. We know this to be true. We have a cursing scenario here as well, blessing and cursing. Oh, you got your attention there for a second. There is a blessing and a cursing, and it's interesting the language here. See, I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse, a blessing and a curse. We see this again later on in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 and 19. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 and 19, the same language. The blessing, if you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, which I am commanding you today, and curse, if you do not listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I am commanding you today by following other gods which you have not known. This is similar language. Jesus uses something similar. Look over in Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. This principle is used in Luke chapter 6 with a parable. Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not what I say? Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and acts on them, I will show you whom he is like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and laid foundation on a rock. And when the flood occurred and a torrent burst against that house, it could not shake it because it had been built well, firm foundation, it had been blessed. But the one who has heard and has not acted accordingly is like a man who built his house on the ground without any foundation. And a torrent burst against it, and immediately it collapsed, and the ruin was great of that house. And we see that same kind of concept. If you listen to God and obey His commandments, you're building a firm foundation on the promises of God. Right? That sounds like a song. But if we don't, what happens? everything goes kersplat, right? Just like, you know, just like the song. So we need to make sure that we're doing blessing and cursing here. If you listen to God, things will go well. Now, this is taught in the concept that today, if you are doing good things, only good things will happen to you, and if you are doing bad things, only bad things will happen to you. Is that what we're talking about? No. He was talking here specifically about them going in and taking the promised land, and that was a blessing that they were going to receive. If we're going to take this into our lives and turn it into a spiritual concept for us today, what spiritual place are we looking to go into where we will be blessed always? Heaven. And so that's where we're going. We haven't crossed Jordan yet. We're not getting into those promises yet. Now, is that to say that God doesn't do good things today? No, that's not what we're saying. But we're saying that that's not the case. This is not exactly apples to apples here in our lives today. It's not, people would take this and teach that health and wealth gospel idea from this. But we need to be careful with that. There's an interesting thing that happens here. He tells them, once you go into the land, verse 29, it shall come about when the Lord brings you into the land where you are entering to possess, that you shall place the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. So there's these two mountains that are just across a valley from each other. And if you want to write out here Joshua chapter 8, Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 through 35, this is where they do this. They have the altar of blessing and the altar of curse and of cursing, and they put those out there, and they have the people separated between the two. Joshua chapter 8, verses 30 and 35, they actually do these things. And he says to them, I'm commanded you to do this. Aren't those things on the other side of the river? So you're going to go over to the other side of the river because I've commanded you that you need to do these things. And so make sure you do it. For you are about to cross the Jordan to go and to possess the land. And verse 32, another warning, you shall be careful to do all the statutes and judgments I'm setting before you today. Are you picking up on a theme with Moses? Moses is pretty one-track mind. Have you ever met somebody and that's the only thing that they talk about, just one thing? Whenever you talk to them, there's one thing, one theme on their mind. And Moses here at the end of his life and the end of the time with the people there, his one theme is remember and do. Remember and do what you're supposed to be doing in your relationship with God. And so we have five more minutes. Is that the first film? Okay. So chapter 12, we have some considerations about the sanctuaries. We get into another section here. We start getting into more language about some commandments and things that need to remember. And we have some commandments about the sanctuary. Here he begins talking about things that they need to do in relationship to the other the other peoples and their religious practices. So here again, we start off chapter 12 with the statutes and the judgments. You need to carefully observe them. Verse 2, what does he say about the other nations? To utterly destroy them, like just wipe them off the face of the earth. You shall tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, burn their asherim, or their images, with fire, and you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods and obliterate their name from that place. Are you getting the idea of what God's wanting to do concerning false worship, considering these false gods? He wants no thing left. Right? We're tearing it all down. And you shall not act like this toward the Lord your God. But you shall seek the Lord at the place that the Lord your God will choose. There's another kind of thing going on here in this chapter. He's saying all the wicked places where they worshiped, tear them all down. Tear them all down. I want no remembrance of all the wicked places where they used to worship. But where I tell you to worship, there you shall worship. That's the place you're going to worship. The Lord your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. Verse 6, there you shall bring the burnt offerings. He talks about the things you're supposed to do in that place. Verse 7, there also you and your household shall eat before the Lord. Why is it important about the place? Why is the place important? Well, that particular place may not be anything special. It's only important because God has said it's important. That's where you're supposed to do this thing. How does that translate today? If you want to write out here beside verse 5, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose, You can write it here, John chapter 4, John chapter 4, 21 through 24. Remember when there's a Samaritan woman and she said, well, our fathers say to worship there and you Jews say you need to worship here. And what does Jesus tell her? Woman? Yeah. So we worship what we know. You don't worship what you know. But the time is coming, the Lord is seeking true worshipers who will worship Him in spirit and in truth. When God has said a thing, where, when, how, what we should do in worshiping Him, who are we to say otherwise? And God here is specifically saying about the place. I'm going to set a place for you to worship. And He even goes as far to say, do not go worship in any other place. The Lord your God, verse 11, He says it again. It shall come out the Lord your God will choose for His name will where His name will dwell, and there you shall bring it. Verse 8, He says, you shall not do at all what we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. God has said, I have set up where you're going to worship, and you doing what you think is right is not right. What you think you should be doing is not right. And so very early on, He's very serious about, in this instance, where they're going to worship. He even goes into talking about their burnt offerings and everything they do. Verse 13, be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every cultic place you see. There is a place where you need to worship. Yes, sir. For example, right? Yeah. So, and were you hearing that, what he said? So in Exodus, do you remember the...
Exodus
23, look, read the whole chapter. Exodus 23 says, don't even name the things that were done. Don't even name those gods. Don't speak of them among you. And here in this text, he also says not to do these things. Do not forsake what God has told them to do. So we will finish here tonight in chapter 12, and we'll pick up here at the end of the chapter next week. Thank you very much for your time tonight.